Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMC ortho.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us in the studio today for Medical Monday is Dr. Allison Grazadeh. She, a wonderful woman, and you'll get to know her, is a board-certified endocrinologist at Capital Region Diabetes and Endocrine Care in Clifton Park. She specializes in diagnosis and treatment of diabetes and metabolism. Dr. Grazadeh earned her medical degree from the University of Buffalo School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. She completed a residency at Erie County Medical Center in Buffalo, a fellowship at Rhode Island Hospital in Providence. She's board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine with a subspecialty certification in endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism. Dr. Grazadeh, welcome. I'm so glad you're with us today.
Thank you for having me today.
A couple of real fast questions. What's really hot? Thyroid is really hot, isn't it?
It is.
What's going on?
So thyroid, we have thyroid nodules, which are very common. We're seeing more and more often. They're incidentally being detected, particularly because people have imaging for other indications.
Right. Accidentally being discovered.
And so we are trying to educate primary providers and those who may detect those on when is it clinically significant. Most often people have thyroid nodules that may not be clinically significant, and we don't want them to worry. 95% of thyroid nodules are benign when we biopsy them. And most often those nodules under 1 centimeter don't need to be biopsied except in specific instances.
There was a Woody Allen film in which a guy collapsed on the sidewalk, and somebody yelled out, "Does anybody have a Valium?" And 1,000 hands came forward with Valium. Everybody I talk to is on thyroid medication. What's going on?
So hypothyroidism is extremely common. The thyroid gland tends to tire out. And when it tires out, then we have to replace the thyroid hormone with most often Synthroid or generic levothyroxine. And so if you do talk to people, you'll often find that they are hypothyroid or they're on replacement.
And does everybody know when to take that? You know, I take it. So I take it early in the morning after I get up and before I eat anything. And that's what you're supposed to do, right?
Yes, you're doing a good job taking your medication. But often people are not advised on the appropriate administration of their thyroid medication, which does make a big difference in their absorption and continued levels. So we recommend fasting in the morning on an empty stomach. Take some water with it and wait at least 30 minutes before you have your coffee or anything else to eat or drink.
Yeah, coffee's no good because it binds, right?
Coffee binds to it and you'll get variable absorption, and then you can have variability in your thyroid levels.
Oh, yeah. And what happens if you miss I go out of the house and I say, did I take it or didn't I take it?
Right. So that happens frequently. And what I recommend is that if you've already eaten and it's halfway through the day, I tell most of my patients they can actually take the dose the next morning.
Yeah.
It has a long half-life. So the half-life's long enough that it's
like uranium.
Yeah. So it's probably okay to take it the next day.
Yeah. Okay. And very quickly then, because there are a lot of people up there already, unusually so. I mean, usually things are a little slower in the beginning, but I wanted to ask you real fast about diabetes. It's really become ever-present.
True. Diabetes is in epidemic proportions now, particularly type 2 diabetes.
Yep.
So there's a lot of obesity, and that leads to insulin resistance.
Right.
So people are developing more and more type 2 diabetes, unfortunately, also in children. So
if you lose the weight, will it help in control the diabetes?
Absolutely. Even a 5 to 10% weight loss can make a significant difference in reducing your blood glucose levels.
Right. And so diabetes you've got obviously thyroid. What else is real hot in your practice?
Osteoporosis.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, of course.
So osteoporosis is a silent disease because most people are not going to be symptomatic. Often the first sign that they have low bone mineral density is a fracture. And so we worry about these fragility fractures, particularly hip fractures, which are very devastating and have high rates of mortality.
Does it run in families?
It can run in families, particularly we like to know if you have a first-degree relative with a hip fracture. That increases your risk.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I grew up on Fire Island in the summers, and there was this one lady. I don't think she ever died, but I do think she just shrunk away. I don't think she was ever there anymore.
Right.
You know, she just... That's why every year she was a little shorter and shorter.
Right. So compression fractures of the discs, you know, in the spine, your vertebral spine, unfortunately, are another fragility fracture. And that's with untreated osteoporosis.
And what are we doing for osteoporosis these days?
So osteoporosis, there's several treatment options. We have some great treatment options. There's, depending on your individual risk, there's oral pills that you can take by mouth once a week or once a month.
Really?
There's also subcutaneous injections that are very painless. You take every 6 months. In the office, or once a year IV infusions.
So hasn't some of that stuff been black boxed?
Well, there's certain risks that we are aware of, although the risks of the serious side effects are very low compared to the benefits that people get when they're at high risk for fragility fracture. So I always encourage patients to work with their provider to look at what their individual risk is. But in general, if you have significant osteoporosis, most likely you're going to benefit from the agents.
So we are here with, as you can hear, a very smart lady, Dr. Allison Graziday, and we'll go to Lou in Altamont. Okay, Lou, you're on. What's up?
I'd like to know what the objective or hard tests are for determining diabetes.
Hi, Lou. Thanks for calling. So to determine if you have diabetes, there's a few different tests that can be performed. One is to draw your blood for a fasting blood sugar after you've fasted for 8 hours. And another is to do another blood test called a hemoglobin A1C. That gives an estimate of your average blood sugar during the 3 months previous to the test. And then there's an oral glucose tolerance test where you have to drink a sugary drink and then after you've been fasting, and then after they check your blood sugar 2 hours later. And so based on certain criteria, using those tests, we can determine if you are classified as having diabetes.
And so the more you're around, the more you hear about the A1C, though.
Correct.
That's sort of a baseline, right?
Right. So most often we're checking fasting blood sugars and hemoglobin A1Cs. We want to have two confirming data points, let's say, two indications that you have the diabetes.
So the morning after, when you take your blood, what is the number that is officially diabetes?
Okay, so a fasting blood sugar of 126 or higher is consistent with diabetes. A fasting blood sugar less than 100 is normal. And then in between that, the 100 to 125 is considered a pre-diabetic or impaired fasting glucose.
Interesting. Okay, Lou, thank you for calling.
Could I ask one more question?
Real quick, sure.
What is the difference between hypoglycemia and diabetes, or is that on the continuum?
Hypoglycemia is low blood glucose. And so although we think of diabetes as hyperglycemia or high blood glucose, in fact, hypoglycemia can be a precursor to developing diabetes on the other end of the spectrum.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lou. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are excellent. Now to our friend Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
I was wondering about the possible connection between the lining of pop-top cans and hyperthyroidism.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling. I'm not familiar with a connection between can linings and hyperthyroidism.
Where'd you hear it, Jim?
Well, I think it was bisphenols, but I'm not sure. I read it in one of the journals.
What's bisphenols? I'm so sorry.
I think bisphenols is the chemical that's in the lining of the cans.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I get it. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jim. I'm not able to give you specific data on that.
Okay,
I apologize.
But when you learn more, Jim, you'll let us know, okay?
Okay.
And we'll stop popping cans. Talk
to you. Have a good day.
And we'll go to James in Hudson. James in Hudson, you're on.
Hi, yes. I mean, you sort of answered my question before, but I was on with the screener.
Uh-huh.
I got a diagnosis of everything else with me is great, but I have hyperthyroid. Now, I don't have any signs. I mean, I don't have bulgy eyes or anything like that. But I did get a prescription for, like, what is it, like a pr- pretty serious medication. And you know what? Otherwise, I'm really well. So would, you know, is it okay to question the doctor and say, because she's a pretty good doctor.
Well,
you know, and say, like, maybe I don't need this right now. Or
yeah, so that's a good question. You're not having symptoms, although that does
I have no, I'm asymptomatic, okay. Totally. Yeah.
So often patients, there can be a spectrum of symptoms despite the fact that you are biochemically hyperthyroid. And so the
right.
concern is that although you may not have symptoms, if your doctor is interpreting your test correctly, that you are hyperthyroid, that that can lead to an acute, what we call thyrotoxicosis, or very active hyperthyroidism that we can't predict when that would happen.
Well, what would that mean? Because that's what I didn't understand. Because, you know, she only has like 20 minutes to see me, you know.
Okay. Basically. So when you're hyperthyroid, the best way to think of that your metabolism is revved up, but the metabolism being revved up doesn't necessarily mean you're more energetic. It can mean that it's taxing your organs, such as your heart,
mm-hmm.
making it work harder. So people can be tachycardic or have a high heart rate. They can feel intolerant to warm temperatures, hot and sweaty. People may feel more anxious or jittery inside, or actually tremulous and shaking. Some people notice they have increased frequency of bowel movements or diarrhea. Those are the more common symptoms.
How about your body heating up at night? You go to sleep cold and you wake up in the middle
of
the
night. Yeah, so heat intolerance is definitely one of the symptoms that you can experience. The problem is that, again, you may not have those outward symptoms, but you may be hyperthyroid and require treatment in order to normalize your levels using the medication.
Okay. Hey, James, I'm so sorry. We got to take a break. Thanks for calling.
No, that's great. That's a very serious medication, but you answered my question really well. Thank
Thanks
you.
A lot.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, so we'll take a little break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive cardiac care for heart disease, the leading cause of death in America today for men and women. EllisMedicine.org. The Bard Center for Environmental Policy, offering Masters of Science degrees in Environmental Policy and Climate Science and Policy, accepting applications for fall 2015, bard.edu/CEP. World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, encouraging informed exploration of world issues, relationships, and connections to the Mid-Hudson Valley region, an all-volunteer organization, hvworldaffairscouncil.org. And Audio Video Corporation, offering design and integration services for the boardroom, the conference room, and the classroom since 1946. AudioVideoCorp.com.
Hi, everybody. Three free phones. We are delighted with Dr. Allison Grazadeh, who is here with us today, an endocrinologist. And, you know, you have a lot of questions, and there are three free phones. No, there are two free phones, 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Tom in Tilson. Tom, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question on hyperparathyroidism.
Okay.
I have a calcium of 9.4, but I have 11 symptoms, and I'm just wondering if the symptoms trump that 9.4.
Okay. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Can you also tell us what we're all talking about here?
Sure. So hyperparathyroidism refers to overactivity of the parathyroid glands, which are four glands that sit behind your thyroid, and they regulate calcium levels in your bloodstream.
Interesting.
So hyperparathyroidism can come in different forms. Primary hyperparathyroidism means that one of your parathyroid glands is actually overactive. And so that would, if you're referring to symptoms you're having, if you have normal serum or blood calcium levels, most often that would not be consistent with a primary hyperparathyroidism, because typically we would see that the serum calcium level would be elevated. Have they checked your parathyroid hormone level?
I don't know if it's been tested.
Okay. So typically, the reason I ask is because sometimes we have a secondary cause where the parathyroid level can be elevated because you have a low vitamin D, for example. But in general, we wouldn't pursue some testing for the hyperparathyroidism if your serum calcium level is normal.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you,
Tom,
for the call.
Thank you, Tom from Tilson. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Jody in Vernon, New Jersey. Okay, Jody, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have Hashimoto's, and I wanted to know if the doctor, is there any way when you lose weight, do you go lower, a lower dosage, and could you ever get off of thyroid medication?
Okay, and also tell us what Hashimoto's is.
Okay. Yeah, hi, Jody. So Hashimoto's thyroiditis is an autoimmune condition where you make antibodies that essentially attack your thyroid. So over time, they're attacking the thyroid and making your thyroid tire out. Mm-hmm. So eventually, your thyroid essentially burns out, and although it's there, it's no longer functional to produce thyroid hormone to regulate your metabolism. Mm-hmm. So in the case where you've already become hypothyroid, that indicates that your thyroid has already tired out. So if you're already requiring medication, then the likelihood with Hashimoto's is that you will lifelong require that. Now, of course, there's always caveats. And in some cases, if your thyroid is still partially functional, you may have variability in the doses you require until your thyroid completely burns out, so to speak. Mm. Weight loss can lower your dose requirement, but weight loss in itself would not cause you to no longer require the medication if your thyroid's not working any longer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I would have to take it for lifetime then, right?
Correct. If you're already hypothyroid and requiring medication, then most likely it's lifelong.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jody.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye.
All right. Let's go to Franz in Slingerland's. Okay, Franz.
Hi, Doc.
Hi.
I've been told that I have lichen planus, which is I get sores in my mouth periodically.
Okay.
And I'd like to know more about it, and hopefully you can help me, because right now I'm having it bad.
I think you may have stumped the band here, Franz.
Yes.
Yeah, oh,
so
no
actually,
kidding.
I think you're thinking of dermatology.
No, it was the dentist that told me what it was, because I just happened to go there when I had it at that point.
Okay, so unfortunately, lichen planus would be something that a dermatology specialist would address.
Really?
I apologize, I don't...
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, because when I looked it up online, it said it was an immune disease.
Correct, but yeah, endocrinology doesn't deal with...
Okay,
with
good.
That. I'm
I do
sorry.
Have a dermatologist. I can do that. Thank you so much.
I apologize.
Much. Thanks, Franz.
Quite all right.
Appreciate it. Okay.
Have a good day.
We're waiting. And while we're waiting, we'll talk about some of the stuff that's come in through the email to us, okay, very quickly. What is the diabetic danger to the 90% of obese people who have no problem losing the 5 to 10% weight but regain it over and over again, plus extra pounds each time? What about converting white fat to brown, thus increasing metabolism? What about gut microbiome transplants, which proved successful in mice trials? And that's from Bonnie.
Okay. So there is some data that it's not healthy to continually regain and lose the weight.
Right.
So we don't want to see those cycles. So that is true. We want to lose the weight and then maintain the weight loss.
Sure.
As far as the gut microbes, I don't have any human data that I can, speak of, so to speak, for that.
Well, that's fine. Thank you very much for that. And we'll go to Faith in Kingston. Okay, Faith, you're on.
Hello, Alan. I had a question for the doctor. I have been diagnosed with Graves' disease. Mm-hmm. However, I saw another endocrinologist that told me that she thought that I had nodules around the thyroid that were mimicking Graves' disease. I also have another major surgery that I have to have. And I was curious, what thing do you think I should... What would you suggest I take care of first? Do I have this major surgery, or do I take care of the thyroid problem first?
Hi, Faith. So when you have Graves' disease, let me just clarify for our listeners, is another autoimmune thyroid condition. But in this case, you make antibodies which essentially trick your thyroid. They stimulate your thyroid to make too much thyroid hormone, causing hyperthyroidism. Are you actively hyperthyroid?
Yes.
Okay, so when you're actively hyperthyroid, typically we do not want to pursue surgeries that would be considered elective. Of course, if you had a surgery that wasn't absolutely necessary, then they would manage that. But typically when you're hyperthyroid, because your metabolism is abnormally elevated, we would suggest putting off any sort of elective surgeries until your thyroid levels can be regulated.
Okay. So all right. Well, thank you very much. I think that that's really what the question was. I think you answered it very well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-800-348-2551. Okay, we'll go to Carolyn in Pottown, Poughkeepsie. Okay, Carolyn, you're on.
Yeah, hi. My question is about subclinical hypothyroid and whether it, if it's really at the low end of the normal range but within normal, whether it really should be treated on a daily basis for the rest of your life with the levothyroxine or whether you can do some L-tyrosine and exercise and all those good things.
Hi, Carolyn.
Especially common among women going through menopause, midlife stuff.
Correct. So often I talk to many women who have concurrent thyroid issues as they're going through menopause. Subclinical hypothyroidism, just to clarify for everyone, is along a continuum of you're not clearly hypothyroid necessarily based on your levels, but they may be in a range
borderline.
Based on the reference range, which is also debatable what the reference range is.
So yeah, varies from lab to lab.
It varies from lab to lab, and it varies as to what the accepted range is. And so subclinical hypothyroidism, it depends whether those symptoms are really related to your thyroid or are they related to menopause. I think that's one question that we often struggle with. And so...
Well, how would you know?
Well, that's why it's difficult.
The thyroid does give you, you get tested for T4 and all the different levels you're supposed to test.
Sure. So if you're on the spectrum where your thyroid levels are falling into a range where they're abnormal, but again, not clearly hypothyroid, an option is to have a trial of low-dose thyroid medication, normalize the thyroid level, and see if it's improved your symptoms.
Okay.
And if it has not improved your symptoms, then you can fairly safely say that it's probably not related to your thyroid. And you could stop the medication if your thyroid level remains in a fairly normal range.
I recently met some people who had thyroid operations. Mm-hmm. Why would you have a thyroid operation?
So the typical indication for removal of the thyroid or thyroidectomy would be if you had thyroid cancer.
Right.
Or if you had a goiter, an enlarged thyroid. The last caller was asking something about surgery with the Graves' disease. And occasionally people who have hyperthyroidism have their thyroid removed because of the overactivity of the thyroid, all resulting in hypothyroidism, requiring thyroid medication.
But in the end, the question which was asked to us earlier is, once you're on the medication, you're on it.
That's true, with the caveat that if it's subclinical hypothyroidism, you might not really require the medication yet.
I couldn't make myself take it every day, and so I started taking it every other day, was retested after 3 months, was fine. Then I started taking it, I guess I went 3 times a week and then tested, and then 2x a week and tested, and I was still fine. So now I'm down to 1x a week, and I'm planning on going off of it.
I would recommend, given what you're telling me, I would say in your case, you could go off of it.
And L-tyrosine is supposed to be beneficial? Do you know anything about that, the amino acid?
I don't typically recommend its use. I don't know that it's going to give you a significant benefit.
And have x-rays helped or hurt thyroids when they're not covered in the neck?
So you're exposed to very little radiation, so technically it should not be causing any problem to your thyroid.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Let's go to Raymond in Great Barrington. Hi, neighbor. What's up? Raymond? Hello, Raymond.
Hello.
Okay, you're on.
Okay. I hope that this question isn't so vague and out of the subject of this show. I have the hip syndrome. I'm 68 years old. It's affecting most systems in my body. You never know who's going to have feedback on it.
Well, let me ask you a question, Raymond. What is it?
I think you'd be much better off asking the doc.
Well,
it's very complex.
Okay, well, it's complex enough so that we're not going to deal with it right now. We appreciate the call a lot, but there are just some things we can't answer. So I thank you for...
This has... That's not very nice.
Oh, you telling me I'm not nice now?
Oh, I thought you had hung up on me.
Yeah.
It's an autoimmune disease.
Yeah.
It's very vascular. It can affect your it can affect all systems. I just wonder if she has any comment on it.
Raymond, I actually don't manage Behçet's disease. I'm sorry.
Who would you recommend? A rheumatologist?
I mean, you could talk to your primary care provider and see who they think is, you know, the best specialist for you to see.
Everyone is going in circles, and this has gone on for years. I can't actually find anything that helped or any defined treatment.
You've gone online, Raymond?
Yeah.
Yes.
And?
No one has come up with any defined treatments or any such thing.
Well, but when you go online, what subspecialty do they recommend?
Well, it involves just about urologists, dermatologists, rheumatologists.
Okay.
Gosh, the list goes on and on.
Well, Raymond, I'm sorry. We got a lot of people behind you. I'm sorry we couldn't answer your question. So sorry. Appreciate it. All right, let's go to Michelle in Munson, Massachusetts. Michelle.
Hi, yes. I just had a quick question.
Sure.
Have hypothyroid. I've been on medication for about 2 years. It came on after I had my oldest baby. And I have lupus. And I've talked to rheumatologists and endocrinologists, and they say it's connected or they say it's not connected. What is your opinion on that?
Hi, Michelle. So lupus is an autoimmune condition,
mm-hmm.
and hypothyroidism may or may not be an autoimmune condition. Have you been tested for Hashimoto's thyroiditis?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so that would be a question that I would ask that could be that's an easy blood test. So hypothyroidism often does come out during vulnerable periods of time. So you just mentioned postpartum after birth of
right.
your child. So that's frequent that we see that happen postpartum. So the question for you is, do you have another autoimmune condition, which would be Hashimoto's thyroiditis as the cause of your hypothyroidism? So that might, you know, give you some clarification if you had that test done.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate your help.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
we'll go to Doug in, well, it's not on. I think Doug in Del Mar has disappeared. No, he has disappeared. Okay, let's go to Maria in Del Mar. Okay, Maria, you're on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question was regarding thyroid nodules, and I understand that at a certain age, most people develop these benign thyroid nodules. But my question was, is it unusual? I have a daughter who's 25 who's developed two. We haven't done anything yet. She's waiting for an appointment. Is it unusual for a 25-year-old to have these thyroid nodules so young? And is there any connection between that and thyroid disease because her sister and father are hypothyroid?
Hi, Maria. So
Hi.
Thyroid conditions are common and do tend to run in families, but does not necessarily mean that the family members will have the same thyroid condition. So I agree that the fact that the other family members have thyroid issues may make your daughter more likely to have some form of thyroid dysfunction. In terms of her age being 25, no, that's not necessarily uncommon and wouldn't specifically raise any particular flags to us.
Okay.
So thyroid nodules, I mentioned earlier, are very common. So 1 in 3 people in the United States actually have thyroid nodules, and most often we don't know about them because we're not picking them up unless they're accidentally detected by other testing.
Okay. I guess they were felt on, you know, exam.
On examination. Right.
Yeah, and she had one that was 1.5 centimeter.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that one, because of the size, maybe something that they would biopsy because of the size. Again, I don't know if she hasn't met with an endocrinologist yet, but I guess I was just concerned because she was so young, you know, and had these thyroid nodules. And I was just wondering, again, if it was A, unusual, and B, any connection with that and thyroid disease family history.
Right. So I don't think it's unusual. Yeah. I think it is more common because of her family history. I do think she should meet with an endocrinologist and they should look at the thyroid imaging because the size alone does not tell us if it needs to be biopsied. We need to look at the characteristics of the nodules individually.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Right. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Now to Doug in Delmar. Doug, you're on.
Okay, just wondering if there's any, if you have any opinion for diabetics on apple cider vinegar, bitter melon, and cinnamon.
Okay, so the question again, Doug, is there any connection between diabetes and cider vinegar, or did I mishear?
Well, are they helpful in, you know, supplements to take?
Is cider vinegar helpful
in reducing blood sugar levels?
Hi, Doug. So I do not typically recommend patients use cider vinegar. There have been a couple of small studies that have suggested that it might help to lower what we call postprandial sugars or your blood sugars after you've eaten in patients who are very insulin resistant. Although, again, I don't have hard data for that, and I don't typically recommend it to my patients.
Yeah, I think it should be studied and should get out there.
You're right, you should study it, but I guess the doctors can't recommend what hasn't been proven yet. Hey, Doug, thanks very much for your call.
Yeah, I understand they can't recommend it, but I think the general population should know it should be studied, I think.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Stram Center, investigative medicine specializing in Lyme, women's health, gastrointestinal, cancer treatment, acupuncture, and nutrition, located 10 minutes from Albany and in Bennington, Vermont, stramcenter.com. The Arkell Museum at Canada Jihari presenting The Artist Revealed, artists' portraits and self-portraits, with works by Milton Avery, Chuck Close, Leonard Baskin, Edward Steichen, Norman Rockwell, and more, arkellmuseum.org. And Gray Matter Books used books in Hadley, Massachusetts. Seeking book collections throughout New England and the Capital Region, graymatterbookstore.com.
We are back. We are back. Thank you very much. And we are here with Dr. Allison Grazadeh, who is doing a terrific job, as you can all hear. A couple of emails real quickly. What are the usual consequences of moderately severe alcoholism with diabetes, and is it deadly?
So alcoholism will negatively impact diabetes because it often leads to uncontrolled diabetes, high blood glucose levels, although there's the risk of severe hypoglycemia or low blood sugars when you're mixing alcohol with therapies for the diabetes, particularly insulin treatment.
Ah, yeah. Okay, and another one from R. Okay, and it is it more important for a diabetic to eat small meals at particular times, or is it most important for diabetics to avoid sugar altogether? And why can't a diabetic eat as much sugar as they want as long as they simply take the corresponding amount of insulin?
So I think that having small frequent meals is fine. Really, it's an individual decision based on whether you do better with small frequent meals or, you know, three standard meals a day with snacks. Typically, we do not recommend that you have as much sugar as you want because then we're just basically playing catch up and trying to treat the fact that you're over consuming the sugar, which is adversely, you know, impacting your blood glucose levels.
You know, I have a friend who's diabetic, but who says, you know, I eat what I want and then I just take the pill, the metformin. So I'm taking that anyway. So that's not right, is it?
That is not right. So it's not the job of the metformin to
allow you to
eat whatever you want. And right. So, and it certainly is not going to, you know, just correct for the fact that you're indulging in whatever sugar you want.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Sure. And finally, by internet. Good afternoon. I am not a diabetic, but I'm worried about a condition I've heard called pre-diabetes. Can you tell us what pre-diabetes is and how does a person know that they have this condition? Now, we have talked about this on the air today, and anything between, I believe, 100 and 120 becomes, in terms of your blood glucose numbers, becomes pre-diabetic. But go ahead. Anything you got to add?
Yes, Alan. So between 100 and 125, a fasting blood sugar would be impaired fasting glucose and is one criteria for prediabetes. The hemoglobin A1C that we've been talking about today is the other criteria. So hemoglobin A1C of 5.7 to 6.4% is considered a prediabetic range. So what we're talking about is that you have increased risk of going on to develop type 2 diabetes, but you're not there yet. So there's a chance that you can prevent yourself from developing type 2 diabetes, particularly with lifestyle intervention and in some cases with medication.
I wonder if you would go over just one more time what those numbers are on A1C.
Sure. So a hemoglobin A1C less than 5.7% is normal.
Yeah.
5.7 to 6.4% is prediabetes.
Yeah.
6.5% or higher is diabetes. Again, we always like to confirm that with a second test.
Okay, great. Okay, now we are going to Maria in Balsam Lake. Okay, Maria, you're on.
Hi. My question has to do with the thyroid antibodies. I think you touched on them. I'm a person who was tested a little bit more fully because of symptoms that could be either thyroid or menopause. And I showed my TPO antibodies were flagged. And they weren't very high, but they were a little bit high. And I guess the question is, should I keep track of them? Should I keep being tested? I'll tell you what happened. This was my primary care, and she suggested I do a gluten-free trial. Actually, it wasn't my primary care. That's not quite right. But it was suggested I do a gluten-free trial. I went to my own primary care and asked her. We decided to test me for celiac and Sjogren's before I did a gluten-free trial. And after that, after I did the gluten, no, I did not do the gluten-free trial. After I did a challenge. I was eating more gluten than I...
And Maria, I'm so sorry to get in the way here, but we got five people behind you, and can we get a question on the table?
I guess the question is, should I follow this? It did come down. I did not do the gluten-free trial, but my TPO antibodies did come down in range, but should we keep testing them?
Okay, good question. Let's
Maria,
get an answer.
Yeah, I think when you've been tested positive for the TPO antibody, and what we're talking about here, the TPO antibody, again, this is the autoimmune condition for Hashimoto's thyroiditis.
Right.
Autoimmune condition meaning that everyone produces antibodies to fight off infections.
I see.
But when we make an antibody that somehow attacks our own body, we call that an autoimmune condition. So in Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you make an antibody, TPO, which attacks your thyroid and tends to make you more likely to become hypothyroid in the future. Typically, I don't actually follow the TPO antibody per se. I would follow your thyroid levels. So I would suggest that you have your thyroid levels usually once a year or sooner if clinically indicated based on symptom changing.
Maria, thank you very
much. What do you test in terms of thyroid levels?
Typically TSH and, you know, free T4.
Okay.
Thank you, Maria. Appreciate
it.
Okay,
you're
let's
welcome.
Go to Chris in Newburgh. Chris, go ahead.
Yes. Oh, yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been diagnosed with Graves' disease. I've had it for about 9 years. I had thyroid ablation therapy and I'm currently on medication daily. And during that 9 years, I developed a slight bulge in one of my eyes that varies with very small side effects, nothing serious. But I'm wondering if there's anything I can do to maybe combat that bulge, anything not necessarily requiring surgery.
Okay. Hi, Chris. Thanks for your call. So with Graves' disease, again, another autoimmune thyroid condition where you develop hyperthyroidism, and it sounds like, I'm sorry, you said you had the radioactive iodine ablation, I believe?
That's correct.
Okay. And so what that is a treatment to basically make your thyroid inactive, and then we replace you with Synthroid or levothyroxine for the rest of your life to control the hypothyroidism. So with the bulging of the eyes, what we're referring to is Graves' ophthalmopathy or Graves' orbitopathy. And those antibodies that we talked about that can attack your thyroid can also attack the eye muscles behind the eye. And so that happens in a really small percentage of patients with Graves' disease. And it can actually occur at any time, even though you've already been treated for the hyperthyroidism and you're actually hypothyroid, you can still have the Graves' eye disease because the antibodies are still there. And typically, there is not anything from the perspective of thyroid treatment that we can do different. You're already treated for the hyperthyroidism. Do you smoke?
No.
Okay. So the reason I mentioned that is because tobacco use is known to worsen the Graves' eye disease. So we always tell people, you know, to avoid tobacco use, particularly with the Graves' eye disease. But there's nothing particularly that you're going to be able to do. I'm not sure if you see an ophthalmologist. That's also something else, if the symptoms seem to progress, that they could monitor for you.
Excuse me. Is it typical for it to fluctuate in appearance?
It can. Often we see that when people, once they're treated for the hyperthyroidism, as you have been, that it tends to recede a bit, but not always. So,
okay.
No.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Right. Let's go to Robert in Red Hook. Okay, Robert, you're on.
Hey, how are you? I always want to report back a quick success story of someone who had to go through thyroid surgery from a big goiter and not have to go on medication for the rest of their life, and which would be the Synthroid or Levothroid. And the surgeon wanted to take out the entire thyroid, which had some nodules that were firing off, you know, this hyperthyroidism. But there was also a giant goiter underneath the chest, which was really also apparently firing off hormones. So he's like, well, I'll get the chest surgeon and take out the big goiter on the chest, and I'll take out the entire thyroid. But half of her thyroid didn't have any nodules in it, and it looked perfectly normal. So the lesson is we really had to advocate for our family member to not have her healthy tissue removed. Mm-hmm. We had to advocate to the, you know, and actually ask the surgeon, well, what happens if you leave that half behind and just take out this? You know, will mm-hmm. she potentially have, you know, normal thyroid production with that other half? And he's like, well, yeah, but I don't want to have to go in and take out, you know, do surgery twice.
Okay. Right.
And that okay. argument
well,
kind
of... Rupert, we have to get an answer because there are a lot of people behind
you. So the lesson for everyone is advocate for your family members, advocate okay. for yourself, do what you can, and don't always just accept what the surgeons are putting forth as, you know, the thing to do because this is what we do. You
so
don't have to do that.
A couple of quick comments. I agree mm-hmm. 100%. Always have to advocate for yourself or your loved ones. First comment on that is that with a goiter, which is enlargement of the thyroid, if there's not thyroid cancer, the entire thyroid does not need to be removed if, for example, half the thyroid is normal, and we can leave that in so that you'll maintain normal thyroid function in most people who only have what we call a hemithyroidectomy or half the thyroid removed. The second comment there is that if there is any enlargement or nodules on the other side, often the surgeon may recommend that you have the entire thyroid removed because they don't want to have to unnecessarily re-enter the neck for a second time because of risk of complication. But that being said, certainly if there's a healthy lobe of the thyroid and there's a good chance that you can maintain normal thyroid function, then yeah, hemithyroidectomy.
And in terms of, you know, the quality of life on sure. on the, you know, Synthroid for the rest of your life or not, what would you say is, you know, reporting back from your patients, what would you rather have them do? Beyond drugs for the rest of their life, or is that lifestyle really not that great?
So the majority of my patients honestly do perfectly fine when we regulate their thyroid levels, but if they don't have to be on a medication, then we don't want them to have to be on it, obviously.
Rupert, thank you very much.
Appreciate See you later.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Susan in Clifton Park. Susan, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling. I was probably about 4 years ago, I went through a blood panel testing. I think I'm kind of following up on another caller, and I was positive for the Hashimoto's thyroiditis. So my internal or my regular primary care physician suggested I do some follow-up testing of my TSH levels.
Mm-hmm.
They have subsequently been within the normal range, but I still have some symptoms. So I'm kind of really sensitive to cold, to heat. My metabolism is not what it used to be, but I am a 46-year-old woman, so things are changing. I understand that. But my question to you is, I know that the normal range of TSH level ranges from, like, I think on my blood work here it says 0.34 to 4.82, which seems to me to be a really wide range. Would it have been, I mean, I had never had this tested before. I mean, I had two kids and am entering middle age. Is it possible that at some point in my life I had an even lower TSH level? My levels have changed, so I'm not quite right, but I'm not still within the abnormal range. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, Susan. So this is a common question that I have frequently from women regarding what is the reference range and what is that reference range to me? Because a range is a range, and so not everybody falls in the same place.
Okay.
And so, yes, there is a possibility that at some point perhaps you were in a different part of that range and now you have drifted a bit away from that. Another complicating factor for you, as you said, is as you're aging and you're in an age where you may or may not be perimenopausal, so you have other hormone, female hormone changes going on, and certainly that can affect your metabolism as well as other things such as temperature regulation or intolerance. So without knowing what your previous thyroid levels are, typically most people would not treat you if your thyroid levels are still fairly well within a normal range. If your levels are on a borderline where you're going towards hypothyroidism.
I'm at 1.66 was my most recent.
Yeah, so typically with a TSH at 1.66, I would say that that's a healthy TSH range. And I would be concerned that if I tried to treat you with thyroid medication, that I actually might suppress your TSH or make you hyperthyroid, which has its own set of risks.
Right. Well, my intern at this point, you know, I haven't gone to a specialist yet. So I guess that's probably my next step at some point. But the way he described the Hashimoto's and how it's going to manifest itself in me would probably be, it would just kind of sputter out. But I might get hyperthyroidism before it dies a slow death kind of type thing. So,
Susan, we're moving right along here because we're almost out of time. But Allison, you want to?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. With the Hashimoto's, the likelihood is you will become hypothyroid at some point in your life, so you do need to follow your levels. Most likely you will not become hyperthyroid first.
Okay, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you, Susan. Appreciate it very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to Jonathan in Greenfield. Jonathan, you're on.
Hi, thanks for doing the program. I've got parathyroid and thyroid issues. So I'm taking vitamin D and calcium supplements, and I'm on levothyroxine. Still experimenting with the levothyroxine, try to get to the optimum dose, so I get my blood tested every few months. And I'm just wondering about the doctor's opinion about something. It doesn't work for me to take the levothyroxine in the morning because I don't have enough time between that and the calcium supplements. And there are studies that talk about taking levothyroxine at night right before bedtime, which is what I have been doing. On an empty stomach with some fluids. So I'm just wondering if the doctor is familiar with those studies and if she has an opinion on them.
Hi, Jonathan. So this is another common question that we receive in the office, how we can take the levothyroxine without interfering with binding from the calcium and the vitamin D. So a couple of things. I would say the majority of my patients do take their levothyroxine in the morning, fasting with water. They wait a half an hour prior to any other oral intake. Typically, I tell my patients if they can't, to try to continue with that regimen and then take their calcium starting off, for example, at, you know, maybe lunchtime, and then they still can fit in their two calciums during the day and their vitamin D as well. Is that a possibility for you?
Well, what I'm doing with the calcium is I take small doses spaced out three times a day, breakfast, lunch, and at dinner.
So then I think, you know, taking levothyroxine at bedtime may be your option, and you just want to do that on an empty stomach. I usually tell people to wait a few hours after their last food intake before taking the nighttime levothyroxine.
Jonathan, I wish we had more time. We simply don't. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
All right. Appreciate okay,
it.
Thanks.
Okay, we'll go to Charlie in Saratoga Springs, and that'll be it. Go ahead, Charlie.
Hi, yeah, I was wondering if anemia affects A1C pre-diabetic blood test?
Mm-hmm. Hi, Charlie. That's a good question. So typically when we talk about the hemoglobin A1C, we rely on that to help us with the diagnosis of diabetes or prediabetes. But there are a few medical conditions which can interfere with that, one of those being anemia. So if you have anemia, then we really need to look at other blood tests and your blood sugar levels.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we are out of time, and we have nobody to apologize to because we actually got through the whole thing. I want to thank Dr. Allison, and thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Allison Grasday, for joining us today. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producer's Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Thank you all so much for joining us on the Vox Pop and for your generally excellent questions. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/voxpop. Stay tuned now for a little theme music and, well, then for a news update.